man who's got it made. Always looking for that renegade. I calls it like I sees it. A spade is a spade. A good man is a thing of yesterday. Yeah. They don't want them a good man.
Good morning.
Good morning, Sean.
Good morning, Chris. Good morning, Patria.
Good morning. Morning.
Good morning, Dr. Patria Taylor, who is joining us this morning.
And yes, the chivalrous guys and the chivalrous doctor. Chivalrous. I'm having a hard time pronouncing words this morning, so this may be a short podcast or I may not participate very much, but that's okay.
Oh, no.
I'm just here to be eye candy anyway, so that's all right. good thing it's an audio format. We're going to talk about a few things this morning, kind of a lot of topics, so I won't start running them off just yet. I know Chris always does our definition. If you get anything you want to say before the definition, Chris?
Just to say thank you very much to Patria for joining us this morning. Truth be told, it is our second go-around for those people that may have listened to our previous podcasts with Patria. We just did a little review on that. We thought it was a good podcast, but maybe there were a few things said. We missed the mark a little bit. So we did a little review. As to chivalrous guys that are trying to learn and grow, we're learning and growing from our experiences. And so we just wanted to have a bit of a do over here and try just slightly different topics and just kind of listen to Patria's story. So we're excited to do that this morning. I do have to mention one thing from our previous podcast last week with Mackenzie and acceptance. I did, in fact, make a gender definition mistake. In my recommendation, I recommended a podcast last week from Alok Vaid Manan. I'm not always correct on the verbiage. I refer to him as he, but that is in fact not his pronoun. They refer to themselves as they. So just my apologies to Alok, even though if he listens to our podcast, that would be amazing, but they refer to themselves as they. So I just wanted to clarify that.
Well, that's an understandable mistake, I believe. So, and good for you to catch it and to correct it. It's important.
Yeah, we're all working on these things, right? So,
exactly. Well, I hope they are listening, because I would love that.
I do too.
Check it out, and they are a pretty amazing person. So,
absolutely. I will do our definition. We had a little chat before we got started here. We were a little bit all over the place. We've kind of been struggling to come up with a title for this episode, but I'm sure we'll figure it out as we always do. We chatted a little bit with Patria before we went live here, and got a better understanding exactly what Patria's field of expertise is. And so there's a few different things to discuss. I'm going to go back to psychology as part of our definition, because that certainly is an area of study for Patria. So psychology, the definition of psychology is the scientific study of the human mind and its functions, especially those affecting behavior in a given context. Similar, the mental characteristics or attitude of a person or a group. We did talk to Patria about the fact that her PhD is in interdisciplinary studies, and interdisciplinary studies combines subject areas to find synergy, creative solutions, and new perspectives. An interdisciplinary studies major allows students to tailor a degree to their interests. Some schools offer build your own degree tracks, other design programs that unite distinct fields. So there's obviously a fairly broad spectrum. So we're excited to understand, what avenues you've worked in and how you arrived at those. So again, thank you very much for joining us this morning, Patria. We're excited to get started. Done the definitions. I think we just want to kind of walk through with you how you arrived, after high school or whenever it was during high school that you decided that you wanted to go on to university and study psychology, and kind of what brought you into this field.
That's wonderful. Thank you. It's a gift to be asked that question, because it means people care about the answer. And last time I talked to you both, I was just on a high, because you're very good listeners. And I know a topic of conversation has been gender for the three of us. And to have captive audience from two wonderful men is a gift. I'm usually talking to other women, or it's just not a circumstance that I'm used to being in. And I think we can get into some of those reasons in a bit. But it's all these words, all these semantics. What the heck does it mean? I would say that I basically, I'm in the study of listening to people and figuring out ways to be empathetic, because we know that that's what works in helping us through difficult times. I think I went into nursing because in nursing, people think about nursing as, put IVs and wound care and all the amazing things that nurses do. But what I in particular love is the connection that a nurse has when you're lying there in bed and feeling very vulnerable. So when I was in grade 10, I broke my femur, and there was one nurse who was just so attentive to me and just kind of leaned over the bed and had this big smile. And she captured my heart more than even maybe my family could. So I remember thinking from that day on that I wanted to do that, and whatever that is, it's nursing or whatever. So it sounds so dramatic.
That's great.
I think it's awesome.
Yeah. So that ability to just kind of be very present. And I think a lot of us that are in psychology, whether it's psychiatric nursing or we're just, in the business of helping people with their mental health problems, I think a lot of us have a background in having difficulty with our mental health, and that's what draws us to it, or that's what keeps you there when it gets hard. I did nursing, and then we can do many different parts of nursing. You can do cardiac, you can do orthopedics, you can do emergency, and I wanted to do psychiatric nursing because that meant you were helping people who were in crisis and having a lot of trouble with their mental health. And then so it all had to do with listening and talking people through things. So I think that's how I got here. And so to dive right into that gender stuff, I think for me, as a little girl in the 70s, I just felt that I had to speak loud to be heard. I always kind of felt like, listen to me, listen to me. Just to kind of, I maybe have an understanding of what it's like to be struggling and to be struggled to be heard. So maybe that's why I'm loving this listening business.
Well, I think you've amazed me already, because I agree with you on nursing. I've been in the hospital a few times, more than I care to admit lately. And nurses are unbelievable people.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're grouchy. But you know, they're grouchy because they're underpaid. They don't have enough help. They're overworked. They're running 6 million different ways. Some people are being grouchy with them. But when you're like, when I talked to you, when I spoke, when you allowed me to speak to your nursing class, and I said, I described that to them, how great it feels to have a nurse come in and tell you, just grab your hand for a moment and tell you you're going to be okay. And that if you need anything, I'll be there. And they're lifesavers. They and you're right. Sometimes they're giving you medicine and painkillers or and food or whatever. But it's more the emotional connection they make with you. It's like they make you feel like you're going to be okay. So, but my reaction to nursing has always been how much I need them. I even had extramural nurses come to my house for a few months. But you took it, you saw that and felt that, but you went further. You said you want to do that. And that is an unbelievable step because I don't think I could do it. I think nurses are one of the top professions in the world. I mean, until you need one, you might not understand, but when you need one, you're sure glad they're there, you know?
Yes, I concur.
Yeah, it's pretty special.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, I've had a lot of experience in the last few years with my mom, of course. My mom has Parkinson's, and she's now in a full care facility, and I just... Yeah, wonderful experiences with those people. It's just such a selfless profession where it's really all about others. And I think that's such a wonderful gift. We both know that, you know, when you give yourself to others, there's just so rewarding. So it's just, to me, it's amazing that, you know, from breaking your femur, that you would, in grade 10, then that would be the catalyst to go on to, you know, to provide you with, you know, the kind of the need or the want to then go on into that profession and then to go through with it, to go to university, to spend the countless hours, you know, getting your degree. That's just such a wonderful, like, it's just funny how life goes like that. And
how'd you break your femur?
Sorry.
Oh, that was an exciting story. Downhill skiing.
Skiing. All right. That's good.
Yeah.
That's
good. But I mean, Chris, you and Sean, you both give nurses a lot of credit and me, therefore, a lot of credit. But I tell you this, yes, it's selfless and yes, it's all about the other person and it should be. But I'm telling you, my dad, he's a salesperson and he says, doing a good sale or working at getting a sale and doing for others to get the sale is kind of selfish in the way of, yes, the other person's happy, but really you're doing it to make yourself feel better. I know, I don't think he was meaning you do it because you're going to get the sale, but what he was saying, we do things in our relationships so that you get something out of it. And it's tongue in cheek. He's extremely generous, but all that to say is, I think it was a healing journey for me to follow the path of, I want to meet other people who are in pain like I am. And then by helping others, it'll help me. That was never conscious, but I think that's part of it. And I think by learning about psychiatry and learning about mental health and emotions and humanity, then you learn about yourself and then you can somehow try to figure out why you feel so screwed up. Why I felt so screwed up, maybe. Shouldn't say you, but so as my degree unfolded and then when I went into my master's and I started doing research and looking at suicide thoughts and how people heal, I started to realize, I think I have some past that I need to work through. And it wasn't until my master's, like we're talking past my degree and into my master's, into the research, where I realized, oh man, I think I've had a past that requires some psychiatric healing.
Wow.
So it's amazing how, like, I sound so insightful about myself, but like you go through nursing and you realize, I'm a person in need too, but the narrative was always that we're such a happy, happy family, but come to find out, I think I have a lot more pain on my past than I thought. So what happened was when I was doing some interviews for one of my research studies, one of the interviewees was talking about being sexually abused, and I was like in my early 20s at that time, and then I just had some flashbacks. Like, oh my God, I don't think I'm this happy, smiley, blonde, kind of on paper, everything's great person. And so, yeah, that was like the late 90s. And ever since then, I've been trying to figure things out and get some good mental health. But so, yeah, I have a passive, a lot of gender related trauma. We know that women report perhaps of having been sexually assaulted more than men, and maybe that's changing because men haven't been encouraged to talk about it and they feel embarrassed to talk about it. So maybe it's more close to not equal, but it's more in men than we think. But we do know that with men who, this is getting really deep all of a sudden, but men who have like this idea that the world is run by a patriarch, and I think we talked about that last time, that the people who have more power have the more ability to be coercive, and then the people with less power have the negative consequences of that. So I'm not saying men abuse more or whatever, but so just growing up, I can just remember like 15 times as a child up into not being a child anymore, of just being sexually assaulted or harassed. Anyway, it's a big tapestry of a mess. I think all of us, it's not just one or two things that cause us to be the way we are, but I think a lot of my past traumas have to do with me developing an eating disorder and me going into the path that I went into, studying women who have been abused and women who seek help for suicidality. I just absolutely love it because it has to do with grit. It has to do with life because life is hard, and I love to be around other people who get it. And then when we can figure it out together, how to help others. Anyway, here I am making my whole life sound like a one big box and then put a bow on it, but that's the highlights.
You feel alone? Like I hear when you talk about, you said like 15 times of being sexually assaulted or abused or different cases, and then you went on to try to deal with some of that, and you dealt with some of that with eating disorders and some thoughts and all that. Did you must have I did you feel like alone? Like, did you have people to talk to about it, or were you kind of dealing
Oh,
with it all?
no one to talk about it, definitely, and very alone. I still feel alone a lot of the times.
Heartbreaking.
I think I grew up with a generation of think enthusiastic and you'll be enthusiastic, and we don't talk about our problems. You don't air your dirty laundry. You don't want to put stock into negative feelings, so they'll get bigger. But that's a part of psychology that I don't believe in. So yeah, I felt very, 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 very alone.
When did your eating disorder start? How young were you?
Oh, I'd say grade four. I started
Oh, wow.
dieting
So
in grade four. Yeah.
it was you didn't eat, or you thought it was like your body dysmorphia. I can't talk today.
Dysmorphia. Yeah, I think when we look up in the books about what an eating disorder is and what anorexia means or bulimia or all the other disorders, there are a checklist. But the more important message is that eating disorders are basically when you have a really, really, really difficult relationship with food, exercise, and your body. And we use food, exercise, and anything to do with that to deal with our trauma. So, I started dieting when I was four because I felt the F word, and I will never say the F word when it has to do with me because it's triggering for me, but it's FAT. And so I felt out of control. I felt And you know, you look at the media, especially back in the 80s and 90s, we're supposed to be so thin, and we get a lot of more, we get more value if we're pretty. And so, you know,
but was it in head? And I won't say the F word either, but was weight a problem? I'm sure you were normal weight. I can't imagine.
I think if a person were to look at a growth chart for children, I would have been in the normal range.
Right.
But I can't ever say anything more than that. I can't say, oh, I was really thin or anything, because that doesn't mean anything. And someone listening, that would be triggering to them, because even if someone knew they were listening to me and they knew who I was and they knew that I was in the normal BMI, the body mass index, just women would be just, I'm having a real emotional reaction right now, because I know that just talking about weight is just so triggering for so many women. And like, for a woman to hear me talk about feeling FAT, I think they would feel very frustrated and angry. So I just know that it's,
I saw it in my own family. My sister's gorgeous. And I mean that. She's always been gorgeous. She's still gorgeous. But I know her weight used to bother her. And what she used to think, she was overweight. And she's a couple years older than me. I mean, she was stunning. She wasn't. It was ridiculous. But she, and all I remember is I was always skinny, like scrawny. And my mm-hmm. poor sister was always on a diet from the time she was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't have. Yeah. It was just not right.
Yeah.
Not right.
Well, that's how we're defined as valuable.
Right.
And I'll tell you this. As I reach 50 and my skin sags more and I look older, therefore this primal thing in some people's heads that I can't reproduce anymore, therefore you're not as good looking. I don't know. That's the theory. I get so much more respect now that I don't look as reproductively ready, therefore attractive to people who would otherwise find me attractive. I find aging is the most beautiful thing in the world, because I'm finally respected and I am listened to. Whereas when I got my master's when I was like 25, and I was always made fun of and joked and laughed at out of the room, even though I was the only nurse in my unit with a master's degree, because of the way I was perceived as being looking a certain way, I was valued a certain way. So this theme throughout my life of being leered at for my looks, and that's how I was deemed valuable. So whether it was, you know, when I was a kid and felt like I could never be heard, it was in the 80s, so I had short, spiky hair until I realized that long hair got you more attention. So when I finally got long hair, and it just so happens that my hair is thick and it's good hair. So when I got to be in grade 8, my hair grew long. All of a sudden I stopped being bullied, because the bullies saw that the guys liked me, and then I had power. And from then on, that was kind of like a ticket to having value. So it's pretty messed up. you know, it's also another power situation to when you've been sexually abused. There's a theory that to obtain self-control, or not self-control, but control of your life, then you want to attract a situation where you might be sexually abused again. Me, I felt that I wanted to be in a position where I could be potentially sexually abused again, and then I could at that moment stop it, so I would have control. So all that to say, I did want to be attractive and attract people and attract the wrong attention, so that I could just say F you, and I could feel in control over and over and over and over and over. I could finally feel in control. So
do you have a hard time relating to other women? Like my wife knows a little bit about your story, but not a ton, but she's never been, she tells me this anyway, I don't want to speak for her, but she's never been sexually assaulted or sexually abused. Mm-hmm. She knows. So do maybe some women have a hard time relating to that because they've never felt that way? They've never felt kind of preyed upon? I wonder. I don't know.
Well, I think I think a person like your beautiful wife would be someone who could relate to me because she's open and probably doesn't have a lot of trauma, I'm guessing. So she's so kind and sweet and open. I think sometimes when we have trauma, we don't know how to work through it, and then we end up maybe not understanding others because we can't understand ourselves. I don't know. But yes, I mean, I find as women, like maybe we would feel competition with each other because we're trying to gain some power. And we know subconsciously, even as a child, if you're good looking, then the people who have power, which are the men, will value you. So somehow you're going to have more power. It's really, really messed up.
Yeah, I know. Speaking from a gender is being a man. Yeah, I don't understand anything about that. So, I mean, I
Yeah.
don't. I realize how little. I grew up with my sister, my only sister at the time. I've had five more since, but I realized that we grew up in the same household, but we grew up with completely different experiences, like completely different experiences. And
Yeah.
it's, I didn't understand hers or try to understand hers. I feel bad that I didn't. But as kids, we're selfish and we just
Well,
worry.
of course.
So, you know.
And one more thing I wanted to pick up on, Sean, when you were talking about, so I've been talking about the power you have when the people in power find you valuable. And that just happens to be with one slice of my story talking about trying to be sexually available, I guess, subconsciously. And the thing is with an eating disorder, it's all about that theme, what's underlining, which is control. So an eating disorder doesn't end up being about looking good. It ends up being about feeling in control. And that's where I feel it's so related to substance difficulties, because you get like an endorphin feeling when you starve. You get an endorphin feeling when you throw up, and when you induce vomiting. You get an endorphin feeling when you overexercise. So in that way, it becomes kind of addictive, and it's a way of controlling your emotions because everyone likes food. Some people eat to control their emotions, and maybe overeat to control their emotions, and that's certainly something that I've done. And then certainly running or whatever it is to feel in control. So yeah, then it's so the eating disorder is kind of like a way, it's an illness, but it's a way of coping with something way bigger, which is the trauma. So eating disorder was my best friend. And then when I got some more strength, and then I think you guys can relate to this, when you get more strength to finally, have more resources to stop the behavior or change the behavior, then shit really gets hard, because then you have to deal with your emotions without the behavior, the substance or whatever. So that took many, 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 many years, and I'm still battling with it today. It's as you guys understand, I know.
Addiction is
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think most people are aware that I think every addiction is a direct result of trauma, whether it is an eating disorder or gambling, alcohol, drugs. Could be television, could be work, could be hobbies. There's so much to it, and I think that the reality is, the more we discuss addiction relative to trauma, the more open the communication becomes. Because we, as a society, and sort of just societal norms, people, through TV, through media, through movies, we see people that we think, are defined as attractive, and we paint a picture of what that looks, but the reality is, as human beings, we're all different. So if you're skinny, if you're bigger, if you're they're just, if you have long hair, short hair, like it's there's so many variables. And having open discussions about how that affects you certainly is a way to just understand people's trauma, and to kind of move beyond just that kind of.
Well, it's funny. I realized it just as we're talking. Hard time this morning with my voice. I was very overweight for years. As you, anybody that knew me, I'm still a little overweight according to what I'd like. But I, you know, I tipped the scale at 375. I was very large. I was eating for a lot of bad reasons, eating my feelings for sure. But when I was that large, it works against you a lot. Like I'm from little things, like every time I walked in the room, I was like, oh, hey, big guy. Oh, a big guy. And I'm like, I know it's my friends saying it. I know they don't mean anything by it, but you don't have to call me big guy. Like, Sean's fine, you know. You get on the airplane, you got to ask for an extra seatbelt. You know, you can't walk into a restaurant with your boss and your customers, and you're hoping they don't say a booth because you can't fit in the booth. You know, back then there was no Mr. Big and Tall clothing stores, and I couldn't find anything to wear, and I was sweating a lot. So I go to a furniture show to work my trade, and other people, I'm trying to focus on how many mattresses I'm going to sell, but I'm worried so much about how I look, and my shirt's tucked in, and I'm sweating through my clothes, and people, it's amazing what it does to you, what it does to you mentally, how much it wears you down. And then you go home, and even though your wife doesn't say anything, you don't feel good looking, you don't feel attractive, you know, it's awful. It's awful feeling. And it's a lot of the bad things that you do to yourself, what you say to yourself, how you feel about yourself. So I guess in a way I had an eating disorder. I don't mean to claim that term, maybe that's not what it is, but I know when there was definitely something going on in my life that was not right. And a lot of it was to do with food. So,
And trauma likely.
Yes.
Sure. And you know, I've sort of been going through it a little lately after I quit drinking. Like, I mean, if you saw a picture of me a couple of years ago, like I was so bloated and, you know, so much going on in my body because I had been drinking for so long. Like my face was fat. I was just bloated. Let's just put it that way. So, you know, as I started getting sober, I started taking care of my body. I started eating better. And again, cause when you're drinking, you don't eat, like you just want to get food in you and don't even care. Like I ate frozen pizzas all the time.
Yeah.
Like it was just, so I started losing weight, losing that bloatedness. I started eating better. I started exercising more. Well, I saw somebody a couple of weeks ago at a meeting, and she came up to me and she's like, "You're so thin. Are you sick?" And so there's this association, like with, and I went to the doctor the other day, and I'm like right on my weight. Like I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be. Right. I'm 5'11 and change. I'm 180 pounds. Like that is exact. He's like, you're right on the money. And yet there's an association that I'm sick. And I'm like,
oh,
what is that? What is that?
I got down to 235 a couple years ago. And I was people were calling my excuse me, my father and my wife and asking.
You gotta.
Asking if I was sick, you know, if they thought I was, you know, Sean, okay, is he terribly sick? And I wasn't even close to my, you know, desired body weight, you know, I don't know what that is. Excuse me for a second. I got to take a drink.
Yeah.
Talk amongst yourselves.
Well, it's such a strange thing. You can be a little overweight, you can be a little underweight, and then there's just always kind of room for somebody to criticize that or to judge that. And
I just wish it wasn't this. I wish it wasn't the topic at all. Like, what does it matter? And I mean this. I would never in my life say anything to anybody about that. Like I saw you I hadn't seen you for a while, Chris. I didn't say, oh, I said, hey, you look great. You know, like, but I think it's because I got so many of those comments in my life. I would, if someone I saw had gained 20 pounds, 30 pounds, I would not go up to them and go, hey, what's going on with you? Like, I can't imagine saying that to people, but people said it, people have felt they had the right to say it to me on a daily basis. So I don't know.
I think some of it is loving. It's loving concern. Of course, because we know that if you are overweight, that there are health issues associated with that. Of course there are. So I think it's okay to have love and concern for someone, but when it goes into this realm of, you know, judgment about you, that you're sick or this, then that, but that's kind of maybe just how we perceive it. Like, you know, because I don't want someone to think that because I'm fit or thin that I look sick. So then it's really, a lot of it has to do with my own psychology around it. It's like, well, maybe if I was more muscular, maybe if I was like, so it's all trauma and psychology, like relating to our conversation, because we have these societal definitions of what beautiful people look like. And so,
yeah, but Chris, you're so ugly. People aren't going to really notice.
Yeah, right.
That's the problem.
Sure.
Well, women and or people who identify as being women or who present as women, or, you know, the expectations on that, and people who have had an eating disorder. Okay, this is how I'm going to laugh about it, because I'm talking to two people who I know will find it crazy and stupid and funny. But it is serious for us, and it's hard, which is when someone tells me that I look great, then I immediately think, F, I've put on weight, and they think I look good because maybe they really do think I look good. And maybe I do technically look better with more weight on versus emaciated. It's not about looking good for me. It's the eating disorder. So I feel in control of my life when I can control my body, because otherwise I didn't have control over my body because other people thought that they could intrude on that, especially as a child. That's huge. So when someone maybe says I look great, then I think that I've put on weight, and then I feel completely out of control of my life. Like everything in my life could be going great. My job's going great. My family's going great. But then all of a sudden I feel like I'm crashing down because someone says I look good.
Wow.
Pretty messed up, eh?
So, well, I don't know if I can say it's messed up. That's your reality. I feel terrible. So I'm starting to think about myself again. I guess this is what this podcast is about. But
sure.
I tell people they look great all the time, because that's, and men and women, I just, that's who I am.
And that's okay. But it's me that has to change.
But I'm wondering if it is okay. Maybe I shouldn't.
I think.
A common
no, I think it is. Well, knowing if you said that to me, if you said that to me, Chris or Sean, I would know that you're not a judgmental person. You actually mean it. You and your wife have shown over the years how much you care about me with my ups and downs. And I believe it. I it does feel good. So it's just what I call Ed brain that takes over and says, hey, Patricia, you hear what he said? That means you're getting FAT. You better smarten up and start dieting. So that's, you know, that's something I have to deal with. So the whole world doesn't have to change. I like it when people say, I look good. Hey, man, like, seriously, let's get real.
We all do. I mean,
but
I like when people say I look good. It's
yeah. Not
very often, but I like it. But is it a bad thing to say to I'm going to ask, if I see, I guess maybe it depends on who you're talking to and how well you know them. But if I see a woman and I go up to her and I say, oh, you look beautiful today, is that an inappropriate thing to say to a woman?
Oh, I mean it depends on the woman, but no, I mean, please tell me that the next time you see me. No it's all good. Like, let's be clear here.
Right.
No,
and I guess no. Like I said, it depends how well you know them, and if it's your friend,
maybe
not a complete stranger, that might be inappropriate too, right? So it depends on the situation.
Well, and the culture too, like, you know, in my formative years, being good looking from my perspective meant really thin. And nowadays it's a little bit different. You know, the Kardashians are drop dead gorgeous, I suppose. And, you know, there's all kinds of different body shapes. Whereas in my formative years, it was Kate Moss and the androgynous look. So no curves, no sign of sexuality,
I didn't find that attractive at all. So, I wasn't a Kate Moss fan, I guess, but I know what you're talking about. The supermodels
were all. But then it was much better to lose weight and to not be attractive, to look like I was a little girl or a little boy with absolutely no curves, was way more safe, because then I wasn't getting that attention that was scary to me. So if someone wanted to motivate me out of my eating disorder, they'd say, you don't look good. or you've lost your looks. Like men at work would tell me that. It's like, okay, yeah. Last year you were harassing me at work because of how I looked and picturing me naked, you know, in the hospital, in the psychiatric unit. That's fabulous. Thank you. And now you're saying that, well, you've lost your looks. So like all of a sudden I'm not as valuable. So anyway, it's like, thank you. Good. I'm glad I've lost my looks. And that maybe that means you won't bother me anymore.
Right.
So I think I'll stay looking like a rake. Thank you very much.
Isn't that crazy what men will say? I can't fathom.
Yeah. And these are nice ones.
The one thing and I didn't mean to make this all about weight this morning, but I do think we live in a great time right now. It makes me so happy that we talked about this last week with Mackenzie, whoever's making the rules, but whatever they think beautiful is nowadays, it sure is encompassing a lot of different sizes and shapes and genders. And it's friggin' wonderful, man. I like it.
Yeah.
I think we're all beautiful. I mean, yeah. Yeah, I think
it is better.
I think there's been some great improvements. Lots of work to do still, but it's pretty cool.
I think for me, when we can look beyond the physical form and just see the beauty of people for who they really are inside, then we'll get to a point where these concerns about skin color, hair length, size of your body, they just won't matter anymore because we're able to celebrate everyone and how they look, because we're not really looking at the physical form anymore.
Yeah, it's so true.
Inner beauty,
the beauty of the soul. Yeah,
inner beauty is what matters for a long term relationship too. Because I'm telling
you, yeah,
it's you got to.
Yeah,
I know. As mammals, we're supposed to be attracted to each other, and that's how you know.
Yeah,
physically, we were made that way. I think so. We would reproduce and whatever. But But you know, in a few weeks it's going to be my 35th wedding anniversary. Blows my mind.
Wow.
But you know, we stayed together. It definitely, you know, I think my wife is beautiful, but you know, she's beautiful on the inside. And if she wasn't, she was the inside, we wouldn't be married because she wouldn't have put up with me. I've been through a lot of stuff. So anyway. I'm making this all about me somehow. We're going to change the subject we'll just put this week's subject, Sean and his shit.
Sean and his shit. Oh, okay. So it's Patria and her shit. All right. Yeah. So back to my shit.
Chris, your shit will come later.
Okay.
You can bring up the tail.
I think as we're sort of getting near the end, maybe we can just touch on you know, how, cause we've been talking about gender, how gender relates to specifically to your work, because I know we talked about that.
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah. So, you know, like having these experiences and, we end up studying maybe something that we're really interested in. My research expertise is women who have suicidal thoughts. And it's not necessarily that I have a great history of suicidal thoughts. I've definitely been there before. And if I was really going by my theory of we study what we're interested in, my study would be about eating disorders, but it isn't. I think what I really appreciate is when it comes down to it, when we are having the most difficult time, I think there's some people think of it as a spectrum that either you love life and things are great, or life is terrible. It's so painful that we need to end our lives to end the pain. So I really am very interested in the latter, about when things get really bad and when we've experienced a lot of violence or, you know, trauma, or the world isn't being kind to us, really. That's all it is. What can we do to help each other? So I think I identify with a great deal of pain. And so I like to help others who feel that. So, and how gender comes into it is very simple. When you look at statistics about, you know, suicidal thoughts, for example, we know that women report or attempt more or report that they attempt more suicide, and men die by suicide more. So, you know, at least by three times as much. And, you know, what's going on there? Whether it is a reporting issue, maybe men do attempt suicide as much, but so far they don't. So, you know, what's going on there? And we know that men are told to be stoic and independent and whatever we think strong is, and strong means not talk about your problems or deal with it yourself. And then they don't get help. And so for women, we are, or at least the feminine is seen as being illogical, irrational, dramatic, and attention seeking. So it just so happens that that language is what happens when women seek help for suicidal thoughts or for depression. If they don't do it in the right way, like look stoic or look rational, if they're displaying a lot of emotion and just feeling completely out of control, then they're deemed, you know, all of these words that we think are against what is to be feminine. And so since the world is kind of run by a patriarchy, run by the idea that you should be in control, we should be rational, we should be productive, we should be strong, all of these things that makes the capitalist world run, then it's bad, it's weak. So I'm really interested in what it's like for women to seek help and then receiving all of that crap in return. And just as important is when men seek help, they feel, you know, weak, and they don't feel like they're welcome to seek help. So I'm loving all that. And
do you think that's why men succeed more often? If I'm reading what you said right, you said, yeah, women, we think anyway, women are mm-hmm. trying to commit suicide more, but yeah, men are more successful at it, I guess.
Yeah. So, and we say,
because maybe men aren't looking for help, they just do it. I don't
well know. And so what is comes out of that is this idea that attempting means that you don't really need the help, or you're not really wanting the help, or that somehow you hope that you'll be found so you'll get help. So we know that people die. People are death statistics, whether they want to communicate they need help or not. So a person might take an overdose of pills and call 911. It doesn't mean they're not willing to die to get the help they need. So it's a myth to think that since you attempt many, many, many times, that you don't really want to die. And that's why women get dubbed as attention seeking, because they do attempt more and they do seek help more, because we, as having reproductive organs, men who have reproductive organs, or women who have reproductive organs that are uterus and that bear babies, we tend to go into the healthcare system more often because we need to, because we have to get checked and blah, blah, blah. So there's this idea that men don't seek help as much because they're not the ones who are going to get the healthcare system for babies. So maybe they're not as comfortable, and the masculine idea of what stoic is.
I don't mean to interrupt you. I want to touch on something you said, because it means a lot to me, but my mom tried to commit suicide. Mm-hmm. We've talked about it, and I don't have to talk about it again. We've talked,
yeah,
about it, but
yeah,
you know, she got a lot of that. Oh, she used to cry for help, she's looking for,
oh, yeah,
help. And then, you know what, a couple of years later, my mom committed, yeah, suicide.
Yeah. So,
yeah, I think the reason people, I think this is my thoughts,
it's, yeah,
not any factual, but I think people try and then they call 911 because it's scary.
Yes,
it's scary. Our natural instinct to survive, yes,
exactly.
And you're like, I've been suicidal, and I've described it as, I'm scared to do it, but I kind of, yes, wish I'd never been born. I just wish I, yes, wasn't here at all, you know?
Yes. So
I wonder how you, dealing with nursing, and that you're in the field of helping people with suicidal thoughts, how do you, and you and I have talked about this. I told you a long time ago, I wish I could go to my psychiatrist or my therapist and say, hey, I feel like suicidal, and I don't want you to call, yep, an ambulance. I just want you, I'm just telling,
exactly,
you that way.
Exactly.
But how do you walk that fine line? Like, how do you talk to someone? How do you know I don't know. How do you know if they're going to do it right, or you're going to stop them? Like, it must be almost impossible
It
to.
is, and you don't know. And the whole idea is it's not our business to stop people, and it's not our business to change people, and it's not our business to say, don't kill yourself. It's not our business to say, stop drinking. It's not our business to say, gain weight or stop doing your pills. If we look at the underlying reasons why we do these things, to get control, to soothe our pain, to end our pain, whatever it is, to feel beautiful, to feel love, that's what we need to be working on. So if I'm going to talk to someone who's feeling this way, I want to work on their feeling of pain. If people want to die by suicide, a lot of the times it means that they feel like a burden, and then they feel that they don't belong in the world, that it's a low sense of belongingness. So I'm not going to say, don't think about suicide. I'm going to say, you must really feel like you're not worth being here. And then I'm going to talk to them about what they feel about themselves and help them to feel worthy of living and worthy of being on this earth by spending time with them. So I might sit there and listen to all the reasons why they want to die. And in that moment, they feel less like dying because I've helped them to feel belonging because I want to spend my time with that person. So it makes them feel more worth, feel worth, self-worth. And I think to come back to the idea of the reason why men die by suicide more often is, yes, perhaps it's because they're discouraged for seeking help, but still they're attempting less. So what's going on there? There is one person who has a theory. His name is Thomas Joyner, and he's a psychologist in the States, and his dad died by suicide. And he has a theory that's very, very well researched that men are socialized to have more physical preponderance for violence so that they're a little bit closer to acts that might end a life more so than women. Women are socialized to play with Barbies and to care for everyone and to look good, by the way, and have big boobs and a small waist, whatever Barbies are. And men are socialized, back in our day, G.I. Joe and go to war, and aren't you the big strong hero? So men are a little, the idea is that men are a little bit more comfortable with a more aggressive method. But that's just a theory. Because it does take, his theory is also that, people with anorexia are more apt to choose an aggressive method and therefore die by suicide because the theory is that it's, you're right, Sean, that we are meant to survive. You can't hold your breath to death. You can't, it's hard to put your head in a bathtub and stay there to drown yourself because we have an instinct to live. We think we're all psychologically in control and we're all sophisticated. We're not. We're animals with bodies that just want to survive. And we have a lot of involuntary reflexes. And so people with anorexia have a high rate of death by suicide because they go against the natural instinct to survive every day by withholding fuel. So anyway, that's just a lot of facts.
Well,
Who knows?
it's we do an hour long podcast, and we're just trying to we're trying to go out there and see what the world's about these days, and see if we can be a better see if we might be able to be a better part of it than we were. So I know, and I want to say this because I have to be careful. Anything I say in this podcast, I'm just speaking about me and my thoughts. I would never tend to speak for anybody or any large group of people, but I know. I can't believe it, Chris. Once again, every time I do a podcast, I always find something that helps me personally, which is kind of why we started this. And Patria, you've done it again. You've helped me again. I won't
Really?
have
Oh my
you.
God.
A couple of things you said really hit home with me, so I appreciate that. I really do. What do you think, Chris?
I just a follow up to what you just spoke about, Patria, just defining gender and suicide. Is it fair to suggest that because of this, stoicism with men and this, kind of stiff upper lip attitude, we don't deal with our emotions. Like, is it fair to suggest that because men aren't as readily dealing with their emotions, that they choose suicide as a way out because they just have this kind of rock bottom moment, and because they're maybe not as nurturing, or you know, that just, you know, that's the way out kind of for men as a result of not dealing with their emotional traumas.
Yeah, I think what you're saying makes sense because you have life experience and you know people, and that makes sense. And I'll just add a part to that, which is men are not welcomed to seek help.
Yeah.
Among each other. Like, I can go up to my girlfriend and give her a hug and hold her hand and cuddle her on the couch if I'm having a bad night, you know, but men don't do that, you know, or not been socialized to do that. No. So
yeah. He's right, Chris. I tried to cuddle with you a couple of weeks ago. You didn't want anything to do with it.
I don't mind cuddling.
You know, it's, yeah. Men,
you know, there's people now that you can pay and go hug somebody.
I know.
You can literally just get a hug for an hour.
Yeah, a cuddle. Yeah, there's an app. Yeah. I know. I'd love that.
Yeah. I think it's cool.
I'm not sure.
we'll do a podcast about that someday, Chris.
The hugging, oh my goodness.
The hugging industry.
I don't mind hugging people I know, but I'm not so much. But
well, you know, everything we talked about today, and I feel like we could talk for another 5 hours.
I know.
It's complicated, but the world is complicated. And I think speaking as a 54-year-old man, the world has changed so much. You know, I just what we've talked about today has made me think about a half a dozen things that have changed since I was a kid and what the norm was and what the norm's becoming and how much we've accomplished, but how much we have yet to accomplish. Chris said a beautiful thing, you know, about just seeing an inner beauty. And we've talked about it before, Chris, that if women ran the world, there'd be so much less war and pain and suffering. And I've said it to my wife many times. You imagine, as a human race, if all we've ever done is tried to help each other. No fighting, no war, no borders, no anything. Just worried about our neighbors and the rest of the world. This place would be glorious. It would be unbelievable. Why we fight over little pieces of land and, you know, this, what's going on in the Ukraine right now and all over the world. It's incredible. It's incredible. It's awful.
Well, I think you're going to change the world through this podcast then.
I hope so. I hope maybe, so.
Maybe a few people to start
changing
with.
My world anyway. I know I was very happy but unhappy when we did our last episode and you know, we didn't quite like the way it turned out. It was a great episode actually, but just a couple things. We put it up and then I took it right back down, and I got a few messages from people saying, what happened to the episode? You took it down. And I said, okay, well, there's more coming. It's okay. And edit that and get it back up. So
yeah, we can always edit it, and then we'll have two episodes with Dr. Patricia Taylor. So,
for God's sake. I did like it too. I mean,
it was good.
Yeah. But I am very impressed that you are being sensitive to your listeners, and we have so much to learn. And you know, I think, you know what I think? I think the fact that you're getting feedback that maybe you have something to learn is a compliment, because it means people want to listen. It means this isn't just a conversation between three people. This is actually, you know, something that's out there for the public.
That's a good point. The fact that someone cares enough to listen to make a comment, you know, and I took it a little harder than Chris. I think I did. I'm not sure. But Chris, you know, we talked about it. He kind of talked me off down a little bit. But I realized, and I know that we're not famous, but I realize what people go through when you put yourself out in the public. I mean, look at a Twitter feed or a post, the terrible stuff that's said about famous people and the rotten lies, and they must get thick skin pretty quick. I don't know. You must just learn to ignore it. It's got to be astronomical. I can't imagine. And I lost everybody.
No, I was just thinking about how when I hear podcasts of famous people, they don't take it well and they don't develop a thick skin. They're a mess.
Mm.
So
yeah. I think the guys that do well say they don't even read the comments. They just don't. They just let it go.
Yeah, exactly.
Or they do like on Jimmy, I think it's Jimmy Fallon does it, where the stars go on and read the mean tweets about themselves. It's hilarious.
Yeah.
I think that's our time, Chris and Patria. I enjoyed this so much. I always can't wait to do our podcast. It always makes me feel better for the week and gets me going. And today with Patria, I love seeing you. You two are two of my favorite people by a long way. I love you guys.
That's such a compliment.
Well, it's the truth.
Well, you're the one of the coolest guys I know. So that's a big compliment. It's true. You are.
That's very nice of you.
Oh, yeah.
I just know when you know what I judge that by? I know when I see you guys, I always get instantly happier. You both make me smile. So that's not everybody. So it's a great thing. So thank you guys.
I have to ask, I can sort of see your shirt, but I think it says my mental illness doesn't define.
Oh my gosh. I'm telling you, I almost threw this out. It is so old. It's got pills. It's not even comfortable anymore. And I'm at the cottage, so I only have a few things to wear here. I wasn't going to wear like a tank top, but I keep forgetting. I live with mental illness, but I define me.
That's great. That's amazing.
Yeah. Shonda wears hers around the house that has Yoda on it. It says, "Judge me by my size, do you?"
Should we do our recommendations?
Yes, go for it.
I'm going full circle. I'm going back to our original episode here.
Wow.
Because our original episode, you asked me who I would have coffee with, and yes. I surprised you with my answer. So today I'll bring the book,
My
Spiritual Journey, by the Dalai Lama.
Wow.
Wonderful insight. An amazing human being.
He is.
And, to read his story, it's been a gift. So my recommendation is My Spiritual Journey by the Dalai Lama.
Fantastic. I will definitely check that out. I've read a lot of his quotes and stuff, but I've never really read his whole story. So I'm going to recommend another book. It's called The Man Who Lives with Wolves. It's a fantastic book. It's almost unbelievable the journey this guy does. And it's just what it calls. He lives with wolves. He becomes friends with them in the wild. He gets them to interact with him just like he's a wolf. But he did it. But he found it, like all of us, he had a lot of ghosts from his childhood, and it helped clear it up, and it got him focused. And it's just kind of it was a self-discovery, and it made him a better human being through animals. I've always been a dog person. I love dogs. My dad was always loved wolves. And I still, I still have a couple dogs in my life today that make me feel pretty special when I see them. I have a connection with them stronger than human beings a lot. So if anyone wants to read something very interesting, again, it's The Man Who Lives with Wolves by Sean Ellis.
It reminds me of when I was younger. There's a movie, and I think it's based on a Farley Mowat book. Do you remember this?
I read a lot of Farley Mowat.
And he lived with wolves too.
I remember. You're right. I mean, I read like The Boat That Wouldn't Float and The Dog That Wouldn't Be, and there is one about that. You're right.
Anyway, right? Okay. Well, thank you for that.
You're welcome. Patria, you got anything? I know you don't read, or you can't read, I think you said, which amazed me.
Can't read.
How you become a doctor when you can't read?
It was called Never Tell a Wolf.
I read a lot about my job, and that motivates me, but I do have a hard time reading. Yeah, I don't know why. I've learned strategies over time, I guess, but I get all my wisdom from my dogs.
Duck.
So, descendants from the wolves, just
what is
how they're in the moment.
What's your other dog's name? I've only asked you 18 times.
Skippy, like the peanut butter.
Skippy, because my wife and me know duck, 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 and then she says, "What's the other one?" And I'm always like, "It's Kraft."
I love peanut butter more than life itself, so maybe that'll help.
Skippy, I won't forget it again. I promise. Skippy and Duck.
You promise. It has been so wonderful listening or being heard and talking to you. Your attention is just a gift. And I'm already feeling like, I'm not here as a person who does research. I'm here as just as me. And when I think about what I've talked about, I'm like, oh, I hope it's okay. And here I am feeling all vulnerable. It's I think that's reminds us that when we have people who speak here that and when you guys talk about your life experience, it's hard. And we're all just vulnerable balls of emotions when it comes to it. So thank you for listening. I
Okay.
guess I don't get to talk much about my stuff, so.
Well, that means a ton to me. It really does. Thank you for being here. Thank you, Chris.
Yeah, it's
I hope you have a great week.
Yeah, thank you as well. I mean, it's therapeutic, I think, just being able to share, right? And we get that in AA at meetings, and I'm sure that people who can share their stories or listen to other people's stories and they can get something from it, then that's a gift that we hope to offer
Yeah.
to.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, now it's time to play the music and watch Sean try to find some awkward way to look and not smile because it always makes me smile. So I look down during the opening music because I
Look
always
into
feel like
the
I don't know
camera
what to
and smile. Look into the camera and smile.
say.
Let's
Bye,
do
guys.
it.
Bye.
Always looking for that renegade. I calls it like I sees it. A spade is a spade. A good man is a thing of yesterday. Yeah.